Very pleased to have a good friend of mine and colleague with us tonight, Dr. Stephen Paulson. Dr. Paulson is associate professor of systematic theology at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, and he's quite a versatile theologian in the best sense of that term, and that he has written not only a systematic theology, which is evidenced in his new book, Lutheran Theology, just published by T&T Clark this year, but better systematicians are those who bring Luther to the table, and Dr. Paulson certainly does that. He's a Luther scholar, has written Luther for Armchair Theologians, which is a deceptively popular book, but very, very, very meaty. And he also writes on a number of other Some of you who are with me in pastoral theology have read his piece on death, which is a must reading before anyone preaches or cares for the dying, and just numerous other articles. He is a student of the Saint Gerhard Ferdi, edited several of Ferdi's works that have been published through Quarterly. and so many of you know his name as the one who wrote the introduction to Captivation of the Will, which I also use as a textbook or the preached
PreachCon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so he's had a kind of a tumultuous day getting here, dodging tornadoes and windstorms, and we're pleasantly surprised that a remnant did indeed remain until the end. So, without any further ado, I'll introduce him to you. He's going to talk a little tonight about Paul, Luther, New Perspective, then tomorrow Convocation, Luther on Hidden God, general parameters. But welcome, Steve, and second visit to our campus as a guest lecturer, and we're very pleased to have you back.
John, thanks very much. Thank you. I want to thank you for waiting tonight. That's a special treat for me. That would not have happened back at my seminary. They would have flown the coop by now. And some of you, I don't know how well you know, but I teach at Luther Seminary, and there are troubles in the ELCA. Therefore, I am a wandering Aramean at this point, so I consider this something like a second home, or at least a place I can come and hide out for a little while. I've just published another book, which John mentioned, and I actually have a copy. It's in the car. I'll bring it tomorrow, so you can at least see it. And I thought I would mention a couple things about it so that you can be aware of that tonight. A while ago, I don't know if any of the students that are here tonight are among them, but a while ago, some students read a talk that I gave on Galatians some time ago, and in that talk, I specifically identified some issues with the new perspective on Paul, so-called. I thought that one of the things I could do when I came down here was at least mention a few of the issues surrounding that tonight. But I really do think, and I wonder if you don't agree, that the time that we could have could be best spent in questions and answers and discussion about anything that might be on your mind. So I want to spend most of the time that we have remaining open to any kinds of questions you have. Either about things that you have been reading from some of the books I've edited or written, or some about my own vocation and situation in the ELCA. I'm open to these sorts of things as well. I'm very interested to find out about what you people are most concerned about with your own ministry. So I want to make sure I have plenty of time for that. But we also should stir up the pot a little bit, identify a few things that we could work with, And let's see if we can't kick things off that way. One of the things that I did when I wrote this new book called Lutheran Theology, not a terribly exciting title, but nevertheless, there we have it, was to lay out Lutheran theology as I think we would find it best, and that is to work with a commentary on Scripture. You know that at the University of Wittenberg, when the Reformation first broke out, one of the things that happened was that the curriculum itself changed, and when you taught classes at the University of Wittenberg, what you did was teach on a book of the Bible. And everybody did that, regardless of whatever discipline, as we usually call it today, that you might come from. And you know also that when a faculty gets together, one of the things that they fight about is territory, that is, who's going to teach what. It was a very interesting accident of history that Melanchthon got the book of Romans. That left Luther with Galatians. Of course, we have him teaching a few other books as well, as you know. But it's always been a curiosity as to what would have happened over time if Luther had gotten the course on Romans over a long period of time rather than Melanchthon. It's been one of my preoccupations to think in terms of that. Now, that was one issue for me when I took up discussion about Lutheran theology as a commentary on the book of Romans. It's also my interest in watching what has happened among Lutherans in the exegetical tradition, specifically in the traditions that that began in the 19th century and come up to the present that identify themselves as critical. Because when they identify themselves as critical, now they are critical about one thing in particular, and that is the Lutheran teaching on justification by faith alone. That's where the criticism actually starts. That is its heart and focus. And because of that, there has been a long, sustained attack on the basic Lutheran teaching on justification, especially as you find it in the book of Romans, though not only there. By the way, also in Galatians. And because of that, there has been a long stretch of withering argument against what is our basic position and our basic source of ministry. And so we have to, in some way, respond. So this book that I have written now is a commentary, chapter by chapter, not always verse by verse, because you have to keep it under 300 pages. In doing so, I've laid out what I take are the basic arguments of our theology as they arise in the book of Romans. Now, having said that, one of the things that is of keen interest presently is this issue about the new perspective on Paul that has arisen, and the particular form of attack that they make on the traditional Lutheran presentation of Paul's letter to the Romans. And we know that this new perspective broke out in its most recent form. There are a number of forms of it, but in its most recent form in the 1970s. Now, for most of you sitting here, as I see, some of you will have to be accepted, the 1970s is a blur to most of you. So now I want to take you back to it and identify a couple of things in the 1970s that identify this new perspective on Paul that arose among Lutherans specifically and then dribbled out into some others as well, and then became a public attack on the Lutheran teaching of justification and the way that Paul's letter to the Romans is therefore taught. Now, I'll say this fast, and then we can start to unpack this a little bit more if you want. I'll watch how your questions go. In the 1970s, we had two major books published and one major set of lectures that were given, all within a two-year period, actually is about a year and a half period, 1976 to 1977. The first one was written by Christer Stendahl, and most of you will have at least heard of this, I assume, though I don't know if this is still on the radar or not. It is his book called, what is the title? Paul and the Western Introspective Consciousness of the West. Here's Christer Stendahl, Swedish Lutheran, so to speak, eventually a bishop in the Swedish church and taught for many years at Harvard. Now, he wrote a book that identified Luther's description of Paul as entirely false and misleading because, as he said, Luther absorbed his own experience and turned it into the experience of Paul, which was an experience of guilt. This is Stendahl. So Stendahl says that Luther himself, as he writes in his autobiography, had a moment, at least, of tremendous guilt. This is not actually what Luther says. And in his overwhelming feeling of guilt, went to the letter to the Romans, not alone, but especially, and then projected onto the letter his own feelings of guilt. Then Stendahl says this experience of guilt goes back to the teaching on penance, which the Reformation never got rid of, and therefore was always an incomplete Reformation, because it retained the basic sense of penance and the basic need, therefore, to overcome sin through some form of punishment. Still with me? So Stendahl writes this, and he further says that what Luther then did was get Paul's letter to the Romans all wrong. Luther thought that Paul's letter to the Romans centered on the first chapter, the 16th and 17th verse, which especially identified this little verse from Habakkuk, chapter 2, verse 4, which identifies justification by faith, specifically, Luther says, by faith alone, as that by which or from which we shall live. All right? So Stendahl says that's what Luther thought was the key to the letter of the Romans. However, that was not the key. The key was not in the first chapter, 16th and 17th verse. The key for Stendahl was in, of all places, the 15th chapter of Romans, which is really Paul winding down and identifying what he calls his mission. So he talks about the fact that he hasn't arrived yet in Rome but wants to go there and eventually wants to go on to Spain. This is in the 15th chapter of Romans. Stendahl says that's the heart of what Paul is actually talking about. And what Paul is talking about is a mission in the history of salvation. This is Heilsgeschichte of the teaching of God's way or pattern of bringing salvation through history itself. So this is Stendahl. Stendahl now goes back to something that's called Heilsgeschichte. Many of you will have at least come upon that term, and we can unpack it a little bit more if you like. And it lays out the history of the process by which God is going to save us. And that starts with the Jews and then eventually goes to the Gentiles. And as Stendahl says, then eventually goes back to the Jews. Okay, so there's Stendahl. Then a year later, E.P. Sanders, who comes out of covenantal theology, then writes his book on Paul and Palestinian Judaism and Palestinian Christianity and begins the process of what is called the New Perspective. And in a nutshell, E.P. Sanders says, Luther is the source of all of our present problems with understanding Paul. And perhaps Paul himself didn't really understand himself very well. And E.P. Sanders comes back and says that all of these people got something very wrong. They constantly talk about works righteousness, works righteousness. And E.P. Sanders was sick of hearing Lutherans say works righteousness in a sermon. If he had to hear it one more time, he was going to vomit, he says. By the way, same thing happens with Jimmy Dunn, for those of you who are familiar with this Scottish Presbyterian theologian, also writing out of the so-called New Perspective on Paul. Now, E.P. Sanders says, what Luther did by focusing on justification by faith alone, apart from works of the law, and pushing this back into Paul, is misrepresent Paul, and especially misrepresent Jews, and most specifically, misrepresenting Pharisees. So he actually thinks that if you read the Gospel of Matthew and you got to the 23rd chapter of Matthew, and there you hear story after story about the Pharisees, and every story about the Pharisees is a story about hypocrisy. And E.P. Sanders says this is a misrepresentation, and it doesn't in fact rightly describe Jews or Pharisees. Jews or Pharisees do not experience the law as something that that inspires guilt, hence the connection to Stendhal, nor do they experience it as something that would produce hypocrisy. These would go hand in hand. And instead, they experience the law of God as grace itself. So here's the key. E.P. Sanders says, Luther got this entirely wrong. He says faith alone, apart from works of the law, which then means that law is no longer grace. What Paul really means to say is that law is grace and can be and is routinely experienced as grace. Jews experience it as grace. And so could Gentiles, but for one problem. Now E.P. Sanders goes into this and opens up an old bag of worms that goes back at least to the 19th century and actually much further. That is to say that there is one problem with Judaism. The problem is not that the law stands in opposition to grace. Law equals grace, but the problem is that they kept it only for themselves. And therefore, they became a separate and opposite religion to Gentiles, and they kept the law as their form of election. And the only thing that Jews have to do now is unleash the law so that the law can be poured out upon Gentiles as well, and therefore become the form of grace. Still with me? This is E.P. Sanders. So he builds his theory about covenantal nomism, for those, some of you who are familiar with these kinds of discussions. And he says, all we need in this world is for Jews to open up the law to Gentiles and give it to them. And once they give it to them, then Gentiles will experience this as grace as well. Then there was a third matter in the 1970s, 1977. There were a series of lectures by Wolfhart Pannenberg at Yale University, which have eventually been were eventually published. Some of you may still find this. It's in a little book by Pannenberg called Christian Spirituality. And I actually suggest that you read it so that you can understand not only the issue about interpretation of the letter to the Romans, but also this became a primary impact on liturgical theology, especially among Lutherans. And this is something that Missouri Synod and other Lutherans, like those that are standing around me usually in the ELCA, have been impacted by. That is, Pannenberg set up a formula of two different worship lives and two different experiences in life. One is the experience of Lutherans and their worship up to 1977, which Pannenberg called a worship life of guilt consciousness. So it's going to make the same connection that Stendhal did, same connection that E.P. Sanders did. That is to say, what Lutherans teach people is to feel guilty. That's what they do. That's what they're there on earth for. That's their great occupation. If they didn't do it, it wouldn't get done, and so on and so forth. But Pannenberg says that is what is killing the church, especially the Lutheran church. It teaches only guilt. And over a period of time, who wants to come and feel guilty? So people just walk away. Now he says there's an alternative. And it's an alternative that he himself now poses in 1977 to the Yale audience. And it became extremely influential, especially among liturgists, who then went out and created new liturgies, one after another. It was to put in place of guilt consciousness that centered everything in worship on the form of forgiveness of sins. This is what Pannenberg said was wrong with Lutherans. They had forgiveness of sins on the brain, and they couldn't talk about anything else. So that when anybody came into the worship service, the first thing they heard was, you're a sinner. The second thing they heard was, well, don't worry about it because you're forgiven. But he says by the time somebody says you're forgiven, they're already feeling so guilty, they're not going to hear anything about this forgiveness. So this particular life of worship doesn't work, he says. Then he says, in place of this, he's now going to propose a whole new worship life, a whole new theology. He calls it Eucharistic spirituality. And Eucharistic spirituality now is going to center itself not on the forgiveness of sins, but it is going to center itself on the Eucharist. And the Eucharist now is not going to be the source of the forgiveness of sins. It is going to be the source of celebration. And the source of celebration now is going to be the form of eudaimonia or happiness. That is, it is now going to center on the notion of the collective joy and celebration of the community, hence Eucharist. This is going to create a new life and a new spirit in the church. And so Pannenberg begins to lay this out. Now, all three of these are operating out of similar principles. And when they go back to Luther, they always identify Luther as creating a theology out of his personal experience, not out of Scripture, and the personal experience is guilt. Secondly, they identify the Lutheran Church with the reproduction, especially in the liturgy, of guilt consciousness over and over again. This is all they can do. And third, then, they confuse what Paul really is after. That is, that Paul wants to get Jews and Gentiles to join together. The only way that this is going to happen is if they all can agree that the law is grace, comfort, joy. And once they learn that, once they have that, then the unity of these two basic fighting religions will finally occur, and we will have shalom, peace on earth. All right? Now, this actually goes back into the 19th century to a fellow that some of you will have discovered by this time by the name of F.C. Bauer, B-A-U-R. And F.C. Bauer had an idea. He's sitting at the University of Tübingen, and he had been taught by various German idealists who were coming out of the teaching from Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. And you remember Hegel's basic notion was that all of history is based on polarities of opposites, fighting one another, and then overcoming the fight and then becoming something greater or better in a synthesis that then will become a higher form of life than was previously possible. F.C. Bauer sits there and says, a light came on, and when he went back to the letter to the Romans, said now he understands that what Paul is after is getting Jews and Gentiles to work together in the same church, because Jews and Gentiles are the two opposing, opposite, fighting forces in the world, the thesis and the antithesis, and the only way to bring these together is to synthesize them into a greater whole. So F.C. Bauer says, throughout all early Christianity, you had a fight between the Church of Peter, which is Jewish, the Church of Paul, which is Gentilish, and what they are aiming toward is a higher synthesis of these two that is going to get rid of the problems of Peter and Paul. And what are they going to come out with? A Church of John. And what is the Church of John going to be all about? The Church of Peter is all about how it is that you are going to come back into the a covenant of Israel, even seek circumcision and so on. Paul is all about justification by faith alone, apart from works of the law. F.C. Bauer still thought that was the case. But what is John all about? Love. Love, love, love. This is what it is all going to be about. And so F.C. Bauer now says that what the church is really moving toward is the synthesis of love that is going to get rid of the fight between the law and the gospel, which are these two fighting principles. And now they're going to settle on one principle, which is the principle of love. Now I'm finally going to conclude my opening remarks, and let's open things up and see where we go. The conclusion is this. If you people haven't experienced it yet, I have experienced it in droves in the ELCA. Do you know what a church that premises itself on love, love, love begins to look like? It begins to look like the church that welcomes all and also identifies all as equally worthy and also now identifies love itself as acceptance of yourself as you are. And the basic form then of church and church life is the principle of love, which accepts you as you are. Now, once you have moved to this particular point, you will see what happens to the church very quickly. The bottom falls out, and it can't identify itself any longer in terms of the great bright light that Lutherans have. You remember Formula Concord, Article 5? The great bright light of the Lutherans is to learn the distinction between the law and the gospel. Once you've got that, then you've really got something. And so what we want to do is bring this back to the center and identify why Luther, in fact, was exactly right, that Romans chapter 1, verses 16 and 17 is precisely the center of the matter. And the synthesis of law and gospel is not what we're interested in at all. It is the distinction between these two that we're interested in. Okay, now, enough to go on. Can I stop now? Can we open things up? And as far as I'm concerned, you can either talk about anything that I have just said, or we can open things up wide. Remember, I have a call as a doctor of the church. That means that my responsibility is to answer any question that comes up. And I have to give it my best, no matter what. So I'm game for whatever you have on your mind. Let's start right in. Yeah.
What do you do then? How does natural law fit into all of this? What is this kind of place? Going back to in Dr. Purdy's book, Law Gospel Faith.
Yeah.
Goes back to his criticism of the Orthodox Lutheran position is that natural law provides, I can paraphrase, another ladder in his critique up to God, apart from the gospel.
Yeah.
You think that's a fair criticism of the Orthodox position of natural law? And if so, what is a, I don't remember what his, what he posits as a, in that book as a work, how to understand natural law, and what do you?
Okay. All right. First, we have to make a distinction. I'll go in and work with Ferdy first on this matter. And Ferdy's interest in and also critique of Lutheran orthodoxy, especially 17th century developments, is premised on an important distinction. The distinction now that we have to make is the matter of the natural law, so-called, and eternal law. Lex aeternae. The lex aeterni is not the same thing as natural law. And what Ferdy is interested in, especially in the form of a critique, is going back now to the Lutheran Orthodox and critiquing lex aeterni, the matter of eternal law. The matter of natural law can have its proper place, but only after the eternal law is finally identified as having its proper end in Christ. Going back now to Romans 10, verse 4, the law has its fulfillment and its end, both of them, in Jesus Christ. Now, the distinction there allows the proper distinction between something like the functioning of a natural law in this old world. And Ferdy is very careful because he knew what the argument was between Barth and Brunner on the issue, for example, I mean, and that was the most notable one at the time, about the issue of the function or place of the natural law when it comes to our righteousness. And Ferdy is rightly, in my opinion, careful about what happens when natural law is very quickly transferred into the nature of eternal law. This is actually, interestingly enough, what happens both to Brunner and in his own way to Barth. And it comes out of a Calvinistic tradition. And the Calvinistic tradition is to identify now the natural law eventually as moving into a lex aeterni, and the lex aeterni becomes the mind of God itself. Now, Ferdy is going after that. He's critiquing it, and he's identifying its the logical end. But he's also critiquing Lutheran orthodoxy on the matter, not of their use of natural law, but their use of lex aeterni, the eternal law. Now, here's the way this works quickly. A person like F.C. Bauer in the 19th century is reacting very strongly against Lutheran orthodoxy as a problematic description of justification. Because justification over a period of time begins to be understood, as the term was, dogmatically. It's a dogma. And once you teach it as a dogma, it is a teaching that you have to assent to, you have to agree with. And once you identify dogma as something that needs a census, assent to it, it is going to become the worst form of law that you could ever have. And people who are taught this way are now going to be taught that they have to believe something like a doctrine or formula of justification in order to get things right. There is a very strong backlash that occurs over against this. Because what happened in this time is to extract justification from its historical situation and to turn it into an eternal law, which is the same for every place and every time. And when it was turned into such an eternal law, it was taken out of its proper location, which is proclamation. Once that happens, then something like justification becomes a teaching that I have to agree with, in the same way that something like predestination becomes a teaching I have to agree with. Can I swallow it? Can I agree with it? By the way, the same thing operates for Satan. Is Satan something I can sign on to, agree with as a universal doctrine or something like that? But actually, Satan does not function that way. You have to learn how to speak against Satan, not sign on to a doctrine of Satanism or something like that. In the same sort of way, you're going to be teaching predestination, but you are not going to ask people to sign on to a doctrine of single or double predestination in order, in fact, to have faith. Now, justification also cannot operate as an abstract doctrine in that sense. And it's that which Ferdy is going after. Because he sees that the whole 19th century now is reacting against the teaching of doctrine that has removed it from history. And what did they bring back in the 19th century? Over against doctrine of justification, they bring history. And history now becomes Heilsgeschichte, the laying out of the pattern of history, and then it develops into this particular description of the rejection of Luther, Romans chapter 1, verse 17, and all of that. And that's what Ferdy is going after. So, justification is not a doctrine that you must assent to. It is a doctrine or teaching which now leads to proclamation, and proclamation takes place in history, in time and place. That's what he wants. Now, the whole discussion about how it is that we take up natural law has to be taken up in another way, as Paul does in Romans chapter 1, for example. And when Paul takes this up in Romans chapter 1, someone like Ferdy, and here's where I'd suggest you'd look at what Ferdy does with Romans chapter 1. It's in the Preached God collection. Watch what he does with Romans chapter 1 in relationship to the discussion in the ELCA about homosexuality. And there he goes in and lays out what anybody would have to call a doctrine of natural law. Simply lays it out. And of course, as you know, in asking a question like that, Luther is full of the discussion of natural law. Melanchthon's Loci Communes is full of the discussion of natural law. But we must keep that discussion from blossoming into a discussion of an eternal law, which is the mind of God, and now forgets entirely who Jesus Christ, the incarnate one, is, and what his crucifixion is, and how it is that we actually preach that. Okay? So it's an important issue. It's very much on the minds of people in the ELCA who can't make heads or tails of any form of law, especially a natural law. Yeah. Please, yeah. Give me your name if you like.
Maybe. I'm Matt.
Matt, yes, good.
As you were saying that, I was wondering how you would explain to proclaim that what Christ's word and the role of the law in specific response to the women perspective, since that's kind of what you've been touching on before.
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. I'll say it real fast. The new perspective is trying to say law is grace. And as E.P. Sanders says, law is grace means you're already in the covenant, at least if you're Jews. And the only thing that Moses' law, the Torah, is going to add to that is how you stay in the covenant. By the way, interestingly enough, underneath that is actually the old Augustinian principle that there must be two graces in order for you to be saved. The grace of baptism, which is given once and gives faith. And the second grace must be added, or there will be no salvation. That is the grace of perseverance. You have to get in the covenant, and then you have to stay in the covenant, persevere. This is actually an old Augustinian teaching. And it was Luther that finally broke through that particular matter, and especially came out then with his teaching on baptism, which now says that baptism is once and for all, and all we do is return to it. That's all. And there is no second grace of perseverance. Now, we have to come back in and say, with Luther and with Paul, that the law is not grace. Law is a gift, it's true. But it is not grace, or if you insist on calling it grace, then you Lutherans have to come out and remember that the Lutheran confessions themselves, as a whole, are making a very strong argument against grace. You remember this? So they are arguing against grace, at least as the Roman teaching has now incorporated grace into the form of the law. And so they're going to argue against this matter of grace. You remember that the great teacher of this is the second Martin Chemnitz, who goes back and takes a look at the Council of Trent and says what we really have to do now is identify the problem with the teaching on grace. He comes back and says this is what actually is dividing us in Western Christianity. So now the matter of the law for us as Lutherans. The law and the gospel must, in fact, be distinguished so that we understand where the law comes to an end, and therefore we know how it is, in fact, established, as Paul says. The law is not abolished, it is established. But the only way it is established is to establish it in this old world and not put it in the new kingdom of Jesus Christ. There, freedom. Even freedom freedom from the law. That's going to be one of the key arguments that Paul himself is going to give us in the letter to the Romans. And so it's unbelievable to people upon first hearing. There is actually a place and time where the law comes to an end, and that is in Jesus Christ. In Jesus Christ. Now that scares people. Because one wonders what somebody's going to make of that. And whether they'll take it and run and do all kinds of bad things with it and so on. In the ELCA, which is full of all sorts of bad things. Morally, theologically, and so on. They are not operating freely apart from the law. They are the most legalistic group you're ever going to find. They simply have a liberal form of the law rather than a conservative form of the law. That's how they're operating.
Yeah, I tell my students, if you scratch an antinomian, you'll find a legalist.
Yes, of course, because as Luther observed, an antinomian is a fake theologian who wants to get rid of the law but doesn't know how to do it and doesn't know, in fact, where it comes to an end. Yeah, good. Others? Yes, please.
Well, what does it do to Romans 7? Because that's the paradigm the Lutherans seem to follow.
Yes.
According to establish the Bill principles. So
yes.
Where would they look in Romans to overcome that?
Yes. In the new perspective, Romans 7 is central, and they have to argue, and they do want to argue, and in fact, almost all modern criticism argues that what Paul is talking about in the seventh chapter of Romans is pre-Christian life. And therefore, Paul is going back in Romans 7 to describe to you what Adam and Eve must have felt like and what anyone who is not yet a Christian must feel like, that is, they feel guilty. But as soon as you become Christian, then this is released and so on. And by dint of their principle, they have to say that Paul is now talking about the pre-Christian experience. But Luther was exactly right here. Paul is not talking about the pre-Christian experience. He is talking about what the Christian experience is after baptism, since sin remains after baptism. This was the great fight with the Roman tradition. And so Luther got Romans 7 exactly correct. Paul is now talking about, when he says, woe is me, the good that I would, I do not, and that which I would not do, I do, Romans 7. He is talking particularly about the Christian experience, and he puts Romans 7 after Romans 6 for a reason. Romans 6 is the description of baptism into a death like Christ. And nevertheless, of course, the great Christian issue is always, if I have been baptized into Christ and I in fact have died in a death like his, so that I will surely be raised in a resurrection like his, then why don't I feel the glory? Why don't I, in fact, now experience the sinless life? Paul is laying this out. Since, of course, the Christian who has been made wholly and completely new, nevertheless, this is a surprise, it was a shock to Paul, nevertheless has the old Adam clinging around his neck like an old bag of maggots. And this is a shock. Anybody who wants to premise justification on the law cannot say that. Because if the law is grace, what should the experience of it be like? It should be joy and happiness. It should not be this this struggle of faith. And so as I put it in my book, this is really what Luther means by pugnat fides, fighting faith, which now comes out and is fighting, specifically fighting Satan, fighting the sin that it finds on its own self, so that when it stops listening to Christ and what he has promised, looks down at it at his own members, which is what Paul is talking about there. He says, as long as I'm listening to Christ, this is Romans 6, justified. As soon as I look down at my members, this is what he says, at my members, and I'm looking down then at my feet or any protruding object I've got, then what do I see? Sin. Now, how am I going to deal with this? Now I have to identify the old creature and the new and how they, in fact, overlap. So now we're in the midst of the simul justus et peccator, which all of these traditions, New Perspective is not alone here, but they definitely are part of this. They reject the simul entirely. Luther was exactly right about these things in Romans 7. And it's the only way to make sense of Paul's argument. First baptism, then the troubled experience of seeing sin that remains after baptism, but is no longer counted. This is how he proceeds to identify it.
Can you connect this then with FC6 and the debated third use of the law, and that the third use of the law then is not the Christian as regenerated, how he needs the law? Because he does need the law. The law has come to its end in Christ, but it's the Christian as he exists in this bag of maggots and sin, and the law still condemns them. It's not something extra, but is that how?
Yeah, formula of Concord 6 and the discussion about a third use of the law, as you know, is a discussion about the attempt to get rid of the second use of the law. That's what this is. So in comes Agricola, and Agricola now in the Antinomian controversy has this brilliant idea. He's going to get rid of the second use of the law entirely. He's going to let the first sit over there out in the rot house, right? And then in the church, all he's going to do is preach the gospel, as he says. And the gospel is going to draw you into repentance. We're not going to use, there's no second use of the law. There's no terrorizing. There's no stick. There's only a carrot. So this is a brilliant idea. Then in comes Melanchthon, like a bull in a china shop, and he's going to get rid of this because he knows something's problematic. So then he starts floating the idea of a third use of the law. But what he does by doing that is to begin to join the chorus of getting rid of a second use of the law. I'm not suggesting that Melanchthon is trying to say we're going to get rid of a second use of the law. But one comes in and says, first use of the law, that's it. Melanchthon comes in and he now says the way to save this situation is to start identifying a third use. Now, here's the thing. We have to identify second use, and we have to identify second use as the primary use of the law. That is, its proper use. First use is alien use. Proper use now is to terrorize the conscience. That's its work. But secondly, and this is what most theologians other than Luther could not easily work with. They couldn't easily work with the simul. And until you learn to work with this, then that reference to the Christian is always going to be confusing. Because when you refer to the Christian, you now have to ask a second question. When you say the Christian, and does the law apply to the Christian or not apply to the Christian, you now have to specify whether you're talking about the Christian as a whole reference that includes the old sinner and the new saint. Is that what you mean by the Christian? Because if you mean by the Christian the one that has the old sinner and the new saint, then we can say that the law applies. And you can even talk about a third use of the law. Fine. But you have to be very cautious when you do it, because you can't fall back into the old Augustinian problem of describing the person as partly sinner and partly saint. And that is always what starts to happen. One after another, the theologians can't contain themselves, and they fall back into partly. But if we're being real specific, and we say, by the Christian, I mean the one who is raised from the dead, who sins no more, then the law does not apply to such a one. But there we're talking about it very specifically, and we're talking about it not as the sinner and the saint. We're talking about only the saint in that circumstance. So that discussion of the third use has to take up the discussion of the simile and what we mean by the Christian, and it also has to take up the issue of how it is that we function with a second use as the primary use and we don't lose it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the Luther's antinomian disputation, insofar as Christ is raised in us, no law.
Exactly.
And does that make Luther an antinomian? By no means, because
in
this life, this side of the resurrection,
yes,
there's always the old Adam, and hence
yes,
the need for law, the proclamation of the law,
yes,
in the church. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of, I think, confusion on the triplex use, legis, at precisely this point, sometimes also in our circles, because that historical debate with the antinomians is not factored in.
And then I agree. Would you be surprised to know that the ELCA functions only with a third use? It functions only with a third use. It functions with the third use, not with the first use and not with the second, but it functions with the third use, not in the conservative form, but in the liberal progressive form.
Yeah.
And the liberal progressive form is a third use, and it makes the third use the only use, which is constantly what occurred. It occurred with Calvin, and it occurs over and over again, and it's occurring in the ELCA. They only have a third use.
Yeah.
That's
I
it.
I think your comment, too, on the simile is so important.
Yeah.
2 years ago, 3 years ago, we had our friend Michael Root here.
Yes.
And he was attempting to make the argument that the simile is ecumenically unproductive, which, of course,
yes,
it is.
Yes, it is unproductive.
Because the ecumenical trajectory is always going to be transformational.
Yeah.
And that takes us right back, I think, to new perspective.
Yes.
As well as the finish.
Yes, the fins are here. The new fins are here, too.
We have to have a new creation that is verifiable.
Yeah.
Rather than the Christian as the one who lives under the cross in this old rotten creation, where law does apply.
Yes,
and
it does.
And I think your observation there about the real champions of the so-called third use are some of the folks in the ELCA who have invented a liberal moralism.
Yes.
But it is a moralism that always does what only moralism can do.
Yes.
Condemn. And so, he who sits in the heavens laughs.
Yes, this is
that
right.
The law cannot be erased.
Yeah.
And so discussions that would, kind of veer off into, third use as something that is going to be definitive of Christian identity, always then falter. And it's back again, reading Article 6 of the formula in light of Article 5, I think.
I agree.
Understanding law and God, or third use in the formula. As long as we stay there, I think we're on solid footing.
Yeah.
But when we try to make the law do something that the law is divinely incapable of doing, that is providing righteousness and life before God,
mm-hmm.
then we've lost the gospel. We've lost the distinction there.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree. Yes, please.
In your discussion earlier about the synthesis between law and gospel,
yeah.
and the discussion between how Jews and the Gentiles are supposed to come together to make all this happen.
Yes.
How does that Eucharistic group fit in with that? How does that all come together?
Well, I think you can sort of anticipate it. When the Eucharist, when you move from identifying the Lord's Supper as proclaiming the Lord's death until he comes again, and you move to Eucharist, which is the form of celebration, then what you are doing is identifying the primary matter in the Lord's Supper as the common eating of a meal, which then unites all equally. Because they are all receiving the same thing. So over and over again, it comes back to this notion that the key in the Eucharist is that from the one bread we are all fed. And it is the idea of the one and the many that begins to be the center of this, rather than the forgiveness of sins, which properly distinguishes the law and the gospel and the sacrament. Now, I'm absolutely swamped with this in my seminary and other places, where the code word is that the ELCA is a welcoming place. And they over and over again point to the Missouri Synod as the primary example of an unwelcoming place, because they practiced closed communion or close communion and so on. And this is then identified as the unwelcoming form. And welcome now is understood very specifically as welcoming you as you are and now incorporating you into the one community. And therefore the theme is participation in the divine life, rather than the impartation of the body as forgiveness of sins, which of course makes us all one, but not in the form of the Platonic mystical idea of participation in the inner triune being. That's actually what lies at the center of this sort of thing, and comes out in the form of we accept all. We accept all. And the way then the Eucharist is supposed to bring us together is in the form of a meal, and the sign, rather than the word, becomes the dominant thing. And what is the sign? The sign then is the sign of meal eating, and meal eating is the way that you bring all people around the table, and they join together and are one in unity. Luther himself played with this in 1518. And Pannenberg goes to this and says, what is the early liturgy that uses this theme about, what's the liturgy that begins, there are two ways?
The Didache.
That's right. And then the theme of the Lord's Supper is the one bread, and we are all part of the one bread. Luther played with that in 1518. He refers to it, and then he drops it like a cold brick after that, because he realizes how that, in fact, is going to be used and interpreted, and it's going to reproduce the old problem of the Corinthian church that Paul had. So that he had to come back in and he had to identify that what they are doing is proclaiming, that means preaching, and they're proclaiming the Lord, and specifically the Lord's death until he comes again. So now you have the eschatological matter and so on, and it removes the ontological mysticism that always creeps in otherwise. Yeah, come on.
Yeah. Give a response to this phenomenon of Missouri Synod, Luther scholarship, of Luther's understanding of two kinds of righteousness, and is that a valid reading of Luther, and if there is, or is it fabricated, or is there a true understanding of righteousness, and what is it?
Yeah. There is a... I'm going to start by saying, yes, this is valid, because there are two kinds of righteousness. And Luther especially lays this out in a crucial place in his Greater Galatians commentary. So he lays this out in a very important place. You remember in what he calls the argument, which the argument of Galatians, which is a little 4 or 5 page introduction to the whole thing. He identifies this as one of the primary ways that we can speak about the matter of righteousness. Furthermore, what I've watched in the use of this is Melanchthon's apology to the fourth article. So they frequently will go back to the Melanchthon's apology there, and then they will build up what is usually called a Melanchthon's rhetorical argument, and try to identify this as truly a Wittenberg movement, not just exclusive to Luther and the Galatians commentary, something like that. Now, as with any of these issues, this can also become too confining. And we have to just watch how this begins to work itself out. In my little cartoon book, Luther for Armchair Theologians, I do make reference to the two kinds of righteousness, but I put it in a paragraph that identifies several descriptions of justification, none of which should be left alone, and we should be working with these together so that we don't become too... Our tendency is to make these hard doctrines, and they become the only available description. And I'll tell you very fast where the real rub seems to come, and that is that we do not want. You know that in the history of Lutheranism, there's trouble in the article of justification between two aspects of justification, the so-called forensic aspect, which is especially associated with Melanchthon, sometimes unfairly, and then the so-called effective matter, which especially gets associated with Osiander, sometimes unfairly. Luther himself would operate with something like two kinds of righteousness, especially when he's identifying this matter of what we mean by forensic. A court description in which we stand judged, in fact, finally judged, the final judgment. And in that judgment now, everything depends on Christ himself in that matter of the judgment. Secondly, we have the description from Luther which we don't want to lose, which is the marriage description of justification, which is usually called the Freilich of Wechsel. And this we don't want to lose. Now, there's a tendency to lose it when you exclusively identify the two kinds of righteousness. You don't have to lose it, but there's a tendency to lose it. This matter of the Freilich of Wechsel we want to bring back, and we want to talk about the joyous exchange. And that joyous exchange now wants to talk about this in very earthy, materialistic forms, and a very strongly sacramental. And this can be helpful when you remember not to use the two kinds of righteousness as the exclusive description. See you tomorrow. Yeah.